The committee will come to order. Members, well, pretty much everyone's taking their seats. Take your seats, Representative McFarland. There is not a quorum as yet, so we'll begin by hearing testimony today. We are continuing this meeting of the Legacy Funding Division by listening to reports of what was done with the funding last time. So, we begin with the Nature Conservancy and Steve Chaplin and Isis Stark.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We're very glad to be here to describe the Prairie Recovery Project.
Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry, I knew better than that. I'm Steve Chaplin. I'm a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, and with me is Neil Feekin.
I thought Isis changed. the beard, I think, did it.
It wouldn't be for the better.
Okay.
Well, we are very glad to be here to describe this project, and I wanted to start by giving a little bit of context of why this we feel this project is so important. The first slide, shows the distribution of native prairie in Minnesota. We know that there's about 220,000 acres of native prairie left in the state of the original 18 million that was here in pre-settlement times. There's about 90,000 of that acres, of those acreage that are legally unprotected and could be disturbed or destroyed at any time. But one of the points I'd like to make is that even if we protect every single one of those 90,000 acres, and it is a priority, it's probably is still not going to be enough to be able to protect a lot of the native plants and animals that exist in Minnesota or a lot of the ecosystem functions, simply because these prairies tend to be very widely scattered, what's left of them. And so that we need to talk in terms of restoration, enhancement of other grasslands and of other lands to be able to put together enough land mass or enough area that the prairie-dependent species are going to be able to continue to survive. On that map, there's little red dots on that map that you can see. Those are an over-exaggerated picture of where there is native prairie in the state. If it was drawn to scale, you wouldn't even be able to see them. That's how small most of these little native prairies are. The yellow area of the map is the area of the state that used to be native prairie. Next slide. Now,
Mr. Chaplin?
Yes.
So, a couple of questions quickly. Of that 90,000 that are unprotected,
yes.
How many acres are protected? How many acres of grassland are protected?
Well, of native prairie, I can answer that question directly. I don't have the figures for grassland, but native prairies out there, the ones that have never been plowed, there's about 220,000 acres, so that would make it, you know, somewhere on the order of about 120,000 acres that have been protected, a little bit more than half.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chaplin. And those that that are protected, are they in state parks, or I see the river valley there has a lot. Where are they?
They are in a number of different ownerships. The largest ownership of native prairies in wildlife management areas. After that, they would fall into the Nature Conservancy has a fairly large holdings in prairie preserves, state parks. The Native Prairie Bank program has, you know, I think around 5,000 or 6,000 acres. Scientific and natural areas have some prairies as well. So it's a variety of different entities, state, federal, and private, that own the protected prairies or have easements on those prairies.
Thank you. I was once told that a lot of the native prairie existed along railroad right-of-ways at one time. Is that still true?
There are that I would venture to say that it's a fairly small percentage, but that's one of the way native prairies were protected, particularly the deep soil native prairies, where virtually everything that could have been plowed was plowed, and those right-of-ways along railroads are one of the places that wasn't plowed, and so that you get some native prairie along railroad right-of-ways. The other places you tend to get native prairies are places that were too rocky, too wet, too sandy, too dry to be able to viably produce crops, and those are the ones that also haven't been plowed to this point.
I was told also that one of the reasons why the railroad right-of-ways renewed their prairie was that the conductors or the workers on the caboose would throw their cigarettes out.
That's exactly right, because prairie needs disturbance. If you don't disturb prairie, whether it's through grazing or whether it's fire or whether it's, you know, any other sort of cutting vegetation, haying, it's going to grow up in trees. There's no place in Minnesota that won't support trees, and so that if you don't have some disturbance, and railroad right-of-ways, as you say, whether it was, you know, by accident or design or whatever was happening, you know, that's one of the ways the prairies were maintained.
Okay, thank you.
Continue. Okay, so to reach this point of what we're talking about is prairies in larger functioning landscapes. Over the last 9 months, a group of agencies and people that were interested in protecting native prairie have gotten together to form a working group to create a prairie plan for the state of Minnesota. We now have a draft of the prairie plan for Minnesota that is circulating for under agency review right now, but it includes Bowser, DNR, Fish and Wildlife Service, Prairie Pheasants Forever, Prairie Chicken Society, the Nature Conservancy, and a number of other entities have put together this plan that has a number of key attributes that I'd like to point out very quickly. Next slide. The conservation vision, it's probably too hard to read this, but I want to point out a couple of things here that what this group of entities came up with this prairie plan. And what the prairie plan calls for is that in strategic locations, large areas of prairies, grasslands, and associated habitats will be protected and restored to create functioning prairie systems to provide major opportunities for sustainable grass-based agriculture, such as grazing and haying. These functioning landscapes will also contribute clean water, fish and wildlife habitat complexes, high-quality recreational opportunities, compatible agricultural production, and thriving rural communities where Minnesota citizens will want to live and visit. So the key ideas here is that we need to make prairie and grassland systems a part of the agricultural system by creating grass-based agriculture that will maintain these prairies and grassland, and at the same time of doing that, will maintain the prairies and the wildlife habitat, as well as a lot of the water quality ecosystem services that these native vegetations provide. So I think the big question that we think we can answer positively is that, can grass-based economic uses provide a sufficient return on labor investment to sustain rural families and communities? We think that they can, and in fact, that's the focus of a lot of the activities, and that's one of the major focuses of the plan that Neil's going to talk about. So the last slide that I'd like to show is that one of the things that's come out of this prairie plan is the location and identification of 36 key prairie core areas. These were areas that total about 1.5 million acres that capture 73% of the native prairie in the state. In other words, there are places where there are concentrations of native prairie that are left, and that these 36 places have a lot of the native prairie that's left in Minnesota. That's not to say that these are solid prairie by any means. It's that there's none of these landscapes have more than 10% of the landscape that is a native prairie. But what we would like to see in the prairie plan calls for is that these areas should have 40% grassland that are part of a grass-based prairie economy, 20% wetland, and then 50%, and then the other 40% in other uses, including row crop agriculture. And we'd like to see 50% of that grassland and wetlands in some sort of a permanent protection. Now, with that background, that's what led us to make application to the Outdoor Heritage Fund for the first of a number of what we hope projects that we'll be submitting. That will look at how we go about actually recovering prairie and achieving the three objectives of protection, restoration, and enhancement. And now Neil's going to be talking about specifically the project.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Just one moment, please. We do have a quorum, and I believe that Representative McNamara wishes to move the approval of the January 26 minutes. Is that correct, Representative McNamara?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I'd like to move the minutes of January 26th.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you. Continue, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. As Steve said at the beginning, my name is Neil Feakin, and I am the Prairie Recovery Project Coordinator for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. I do want to just take a couple minutes here today and talk about the project that we're working on, which was funded last session through the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council and the Legacy Grant funds. We're really approaching this prairie protection project with a two-prong approach. One is acquisition strategy for key remnant native prairie parcels. And then the other is to work with public land management agencies like the DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Bowser to enhance land management on publicly owned lands. And we're really taking a couple of approaches to that. One is to try and drive economic revenues off of these conservation-based lands. The parcels that we acquire, we're paying property taxes on those, and we're working with Cattlemen's Association, Minnesota Conservation Grazing Association, to try and find mechanisms so that we can drive revenue from those lands in order to continue to pay property taxes and also to help pay for those land management costs over the long term. So prescribed grazing is a key strategy that we're employing, but we're also working on prescribed fire. It's been identified that one of the things that's really lacking, what's really required for prairie management is fire, some kind of disturbance. So we think that through this project, we can help the agencies build their capacity to put a lot more fire on the landscape. Invasive species management is another issue that we're addressing with our agency partners. We're looking at doing assessments of the lands and then doing the actual on-the-ground management as it's identified. And then fourth is biofuels potential, using some of these grasslands to drive, again, to drive those economic uses, looking at potential for biomass harvest. To date, we've been working on this project for about 6 months. We received about $3.65 million. And to date, we've protected 867 acres within three parcels. Our original goal was 1,000 acres, so we're at about 87% of our goal. We've used only about 60% of our protection budget, so we think we're making very efficient and effective use of that money. And I'd like to point out that the parcels that we have identified and purchased are contributing to larger habitat blocks. We're not buying lands that are in islands of conservation. We're very strategically trying to work within other agency lands and conservancy holdings as well so that we can build those migratory wildlife corridors and habitat blocks. And I've got the three examples of what we've done to date. Clay County, near the Fargo area, we've protected roughly 460 acres of remnant native prairie, and this parcel has been used for grazing in the past. We fully intend to keep that grazing use. We are developing a conservation-based grazing plan so that we can keep those cattle on the landscape, but also use it to rejuvenate the prairie. It is a good example of native prairie. With a little bit improved management, we think we can really drive a lot of additional wildlife benefits from this. Using different rotational grazing systems. The pictures are a little bit small, and I apologize for that, but really a couple of the species that we're benefiting here are the sharp-tailed grouse and the western prairie fringe orchid, which is a state-listed endangered species. So all of these parcels that I'm talking about are going to be open for public hunting and public access as accorded with the grant agreement and the statute. The second parcel that we've acquired is a 160-acre parcel in Lac La Parle County. This is adjacent to Nature Conservancy holdings of about 663 acres. So together we've created about an 800-plus acre block of habitat. Again, this one has been set up for grazing in the past. We fully intend to keep that use on the landscape. Some of the species that we're benefiting here are the Dakota skipper. There's a lot of fur bearer and other small mammals that we're using, and this is also a key spot for waterfowl nesting area as identified by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then the final parcel that I want to just mention is Polk County near Crookston. This is another 160 acres which is, it's a fairly small parcel, but it connects to the Mentor Wildlife Management Area, which is a large parcel. This helps complete that block. It's going to make additional management on that wildlife management area possible. We're going to be able to do a lot better prescribed burns. We're going to work this into a rotational grazing system on the WMA with some fencing, and it's going to allow the WMA to have additional and longer rest periods, which should help the grasslands. And some of the species we're working on protecting here are the greater prairie chicken and the marbled godwit. And I think that's about the highlights that I wanted to touch on with this project. So with that, I guess we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. Now, I don't know whichever of you can answer again, but $6.5 million is what you've received? Is that right?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, $3.6 million is what we received last year.
Last year. What about, okay. And how much of that is remaining? Have you spent it all yet?
Mr. Chair, no, we haven't. We've spent about, I'd say roughly $1.5 million of that. So we've got $2 million, a large part of which will go towards this enhancement work, putting infrastructure in on WMAs, not just restricted to these three parcels, but on larger DNR holdings and Fish and Wildlife Service holdings as well, building fences, putting watering structures in, doing prescribed burning, getting additional capacity on the ground.
Thank you. Do you expect that next summer you'll be spending the rest of it? Is that the plan?
Mr. Chair, the project is designed to go through 2013, so we fully expect to start putting implementing land management this spring, but we expect to have two full field seasons of work.
Okay. Questions? Representative Wagenius.
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of your presentation. I take it this is heritage money that you're talking about. It's my understanding that you are going to be getting some LCCMR money.
Yes.
And are you getting additional heritage money? And if you just tell us how they all relate.
Mr. Chaplin, or?
I'll start with that and then let Neil add anything. The way that I view this, those two projects, the LCCMR, Reconnecting Minnesota's Prairie, Fragmented Prairie Landscape, and this Prairie Recovery Project, is that the LCCMR project is focused mostly on planning. And that includes not only the sort of the conservation planning for some of the a number of these key landscapes. We're going to probably be working on four or five of the key landscapes that I showed. It also includes some funding for restoration planning for a couple of the key landscapes. But the biggest component is for an economic analysis, looking at how grass-based agriculture can be profitable within these prairie landscapes, these grass-based agricultural landscapes. The Prairie Recovery Project is very much implementation. It's not planning. It's talking about how you enhance. It's actually conducting the enhancement, restoration, and protection in two. It's focused on more than two of the landscapes. The enhancement part of it. But the actual work that's going to be focused, that we're hiring individuals to carry out the work, are going to be focused at the Glacial Lakes landscape area in Pope County, and then the Tallgrass Aspen Parkland project up in Kitson and Roseau counties.
And to build on that, we are requesting funds for the next funding cycle. And we anticipate expanding our work from the two project areas that Steve just mentioned to two additional areas, likely the Lac La Parle and the Northern Agassiz Beach Ridges area. So we see opportunities within all four of those landscapes and needs within all four of those landscapes to do additional work. So yes, we do anticipate and hope to receive additional heritage money.
Anything else? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, Nature Conservancy has been around for quite a while and has been acquiring real estate for some time. Do you continue to do that with private funds?
Neil. What's your last name? We missed it.
Feeken. Feeken, F-E-E-K-E-N.
Continue.
Thank you. Yes, we do continue to acquire properties with private funds. We're, like many nonprofits, the last couple of years have been very challenging, but we do still have success with private funders, with private donors, other foundations, other funding sources, and we anticipate using a lot of those funds as match towards heritage funding.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feeken, so when you acquire these properties with private funds, what happens to them?
Mr. Feeken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, when we acquire properties with private funds, they are largely incorporated into our existing preserves. We have blocks of habitat and protected lands across the state, and we typically, when we acquire lands, we try and acquire lands that help fill out those either an in-holding or a boundary so that they're incorporated into that, which makes our management for those lands much easier. So we tend to own and hold lands that we buy with private funds.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feeken, do any of those lands that you acquire with private funds end up being transferred in ownership to DNR or other state agencies?
Mr. Feeken.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, occasionally they do. We do work closely with the DNR to do what we call assists or co-ops. If there's a parcel that they're particularly interested in, but they need some assistance to move the deal, if there's a landowner that's anxious to sell on a very short order, we'll provide assistance. Lands that we specifically raise funds for and we buy, we tend to hold. So it's only in a co-op situation where we're providing an assistance to the DNR where we typically will turn those properties over.
Mr. Torkelson, Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Feeken, approximately how many acres does the Nature Conservancy own currently in the state of Minnesota, and how many acres have they acquired and transferred to DNR? Just rough numbers. I'm not asking for an exact figure.
I'm going to take a look to my right here and see if Steve will help me out there.
Mr. Chapman.
I'm afraid if I say anything, it's going to be wrong. So could we get back to you on those numbers?
Mr. Chair, testifiers, thank you. I'd appreciate that information.
Okay.
Other questions or comments from members? Well, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll have a presentation by Mr. John Tuma, former Representative Tuma. We've been one of our concerns in going through this is the process of the last year, how we have disbursed money, how it's been used, and Mr. Tuma from Conservation Minnesota is making some comments about our process. And so, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Tuma. I'm with Conservation Minnesota. We are a statewide conservation organization who is dedicated to developing strategic alliances that will enhance and protect Minnesota's wild places, parks, lakes, and rivers. I'm also here with Sheila Smith, and I'll just let herself introduce herself.
Chairman, members, my name is Sheila Smith. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, and we contributed to the Conservation Minnesota Report.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, since about 2002, Conservation Minnesota has performed an annual analysis of conservation funding and environmental funding. This year, we kind of did a collaborative effort with the with MCA because we wanted to take a look at how the legacy funds were integrating into kind of the existing trends that have been going on in the state with regards to conservation funding. And frankly, we are new partners in this effort, and we believe in collaboration. And so we thought it was smart for us to now work with our friends who are part of this whole legacy thing that was created back in 2008 by the voters in Minnesota. First, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what has occurred in conservation funding. I'll punt it over to Sheila. She'll talk a little bit what has happened and identify some of the things that were found in our report with regards to the other legacy funding. What you see in front of you, I don't know if I want the questions or not during the cut.
Oh, sorry. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Excuse me for interrupting before you start, but is this the report that was Steve Morse traveled to the Northeast Minnesota before the election and talked to various candidates about, or was that a different report?
Mr. Tuma.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the answer is yes. This is the report that a lot of conservation groups used to identify the downward trend as far as funding in conservation area that, in a sense, led to us cooperating together to push for the dedicated funding amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, continue, please.
Mr. Chair, just so you kind of get an idea what this fund includes, what the numbers we're dealing with, because it's different than what you would necessarily consider your funding categories or your omnibus bills. We break it down a little bit. So I want you to understand what goes into these numbers. It is DNR, but not PILT, payment in lieu of taxes. If you're familiar with that, that is a state aid program going towards local units of government who may have state-owned land in their areas. DNR is a pass-through for that money. It just basically shows up at DNR, and then they give it to revenue to be passed on to local units of government. So PILT numbers are not in there, but all of DNR is otherwise in there. All of PCA and all of Bowser are in the numbers that we use. Ag is in there for their conservation and septic and feedlot type programs. Also in there is the Public Finance Authority for their wastewater treatment and other wastewater programs that they fund. And then we also have a portion of the Met Council in there because Met Council has a significant part of their work, which is parks. We don't include the transit parts of Met Council or some of the other planning stuff, but the parks part of Met Council we do pick up. What this first graph is showing you is that through a series of budget deficits, there was a significant decline starting in 2002 in general fund. These are the actual dollars appropriated in those areas. You see there's a little bit of yellow line there back in 2007 when we hit the low mark of only where we hit a low mark in 2006. There was some one-time dollars floating around, and so those one-time dollars went into funding what was known as the Clean Water Legacy. If you remember, that was the beginning of that in Minnesota. We put some of those one-time dollars towards those efforts to start testing and identifying some of our contaminated waters. This here gives you a bigger snapshot. This is using a percentage of the general fund. Prior to 2001, as you can see, Minnesota provided about somewhere in the neighborhood of 2% of its general fund budget towards conservation and environment programming. As you can see, starting in 2002, after the 9/11 tax and some of the other crises that we faced in 2003, that percentage of the general fund started to decline significantly, dropping down to its low of 1% in 2006, which, by the way, is where we're at right now in 2011, at 1%. This was a significant event for us in 2006. As you can see, this is a real loss of dollars. Fee increases propped up some of our programs, so your water fees, what you pay for licensors for your boats and for hunting and fishing, help prop up with this, but still, even during that period of time leading up to 2006, there was a $40 million drop in non-inflation adjusted dollars. If you adjusted for inflation, the obvious buying power of that $40 million drop was significant. This affected a lot of our programming. It reduced our FTEs by over 400 people in this area. So that was pretty significant. That was what really gave the impetus for a lot of our organizations starting in 2006 to to start collaborating with each other and seeing if there's something we can do. Now, a lot of people ask, you know, you use the general fund. Well, isn't conservation and environment funding in the DNR and PCA, isn't that mostly dedicated funds or fees or federal money coming passing through to you? And the answer is yes. The majority of our budgets do come from those areas. But if you take all state funding as a percentage of all of our funding, you can see starting in 2001, we even still have a drop. It's not as bad as the general fund drop because, as I indicated, we started to prop up a lot of our funding with fee increases, which conservation groups and hunting and fishing groups were supportive, knowing the significant impact it was having on our programs. And it really was the impetus back in 2006 that led to things like the Duck Rally and us working with the arts community to put the legacy amendment on the ballot. And it was successful. More people voted for the legacy amendment than voted for anything else in Minnesota's history. Not even Alan Page got more votes than the legacy funds. So we've done pretty good in promoting that. It was a high risk. I don't know where we would be today had that not passed, but the Minnesota voters do value our legacy of both culture and the arts and our outdoors, our water, and our wild places. The analysis of this budget, where we've been now for the first year. Now, understand, we only can really look at the first year of legacy funding, which is not a full picture of that. We have a budget for next year, okay, so it gives us some idea of a general trends of things that are going on, but really only had a chance to look back at 1 year of funding. And I think there's 4 points that we want to touch for on the conservation area. Despite significant cuts that you've had to face because of the budget crisis you're in, you're able to hold us at roughly 1%. And we told you that's kind of one of our standards. If we could just keep the general fund at 1%, you're doing good. And we say that, I don't want to say that's a legal standard. A lot of people confuse when I talk about here is our principle we lay out for you as if somehow we're saying that's the legal standard by which someone might sue you in the future over with regards to whether it's supplanting or supplementing of the funds. It's not. It is just one of those guidelines that we're laying out for you that is probably a pretty safe place to be. If you can keep us at 1% of the general fund in these areas, you're doing good. And one of those other areas that we kind of point to is don't raid our statutorily dedicated funds. This would be like lottery and lieu or our fishing license, the Game and Fish Fund. Don't raid those to try to fund other general fund obligations. This last report, there were not too many raids. There were two that caused us a little concern. One was to the closed landfill fund. You took about $48 million that you wisely set aside over a number of years to start closing landfills that you have to clean up, which will start happening in this decade. And you took that money, $48 million that you had banked away to do good work, and you took it for one-time expenditures to balance the budget last year. Now, you did promise to pay it back in 2014, okay? And we're going to hold you to that. We just want you to know that that $48 million, when you start paying back, is not going to be counted towards that 1% of general fund commitment, okay? You took it to fill in the general fund hole. We expect you to pay it back with general fund dollars that we're not going to count towards being good conservation expenditure. You're just paying back an account that you took from it. So we're going to try to hold you to that. That's something that causes us concern, given the significance of the budget crisis that you face right now, whether that closed landfill fund will be paid back. And there was also $8 million taken from the Petro Tank Release Fund, and that causes us concern, and we talk about that in the report. The third thing I want to point out is that your bonding dollars should be remain at a traditional level. We talk about 22.2%. Over the last 10 years, that's been the traditional level of bonding that has gone towards, or capital investments that have gone towards, conservation and outdoor activities. And we'd like to see that continue. You did that. The governor vetoed a significant portion of that bill. It still, he did not take us below 22%. So you didn't violate that kind of standard we laid out for you. But there are two things that caused us a lot of concern in the line item vetoes the governor did to that bill. He line item vetoed $21.5 million of parks and trails, almost all of the parks and trails funding. He also vetoed the RIM Wildlife Wetlands Reserve Program, or RIM WRP, $25 million. This is for purchasing and setting aside critical wildlife lands and restoring them, or wetlands and restoring them. Those were both vetoed, and then you already had commitments from the legacy accounts to pay for those items. That starts to look a lot like supplanting, and it caused us some concern. And so we would like the agencies to explain how they're going to make up for that. We understand the intricacies of committing to this through the community and citizens process, which we strongly support, and then later having it swept out from under you in a late end of session veto. And so we understand how that created something that you probably didn't actually intend to do, but if it continues in that pattern, that starts to look a lot like supplanting. Overall, the legacy funds are beginning to restore the state investment to conservations from their previously enjoyed levels. And I say restore. I think there's a misconception out there somehow we're somewhat rolling in the dough. We can't spend it fast enough. I don't think that's true. From what we're talking to, the people we talk to, they're behind in staff because we lost 400 FTEs, okay, a few years ago, so they're having a hard time keeping up to the backlog of need that's out there. And I think this is the graph that I want to kind of sear into your heads and tell to your colleagues that there's not like all this extra money that we're floating in. The two blue lines are now the funding levels of all of our funds if you put the legacy into the picture. And as you can see, your projection for next year gets you back to almost the historical level of what funding used to be for conservation in Minnesota. So you really have only restored the level of funding that we've enjoyed for decades prior to the downturn starting in 2002. And it's important to understand that what our groups and our agencies are working so hard to do is to fill in some of the backlogs that have developed over this last decade. This kind of gives you an idea where we're spending the money. I think there's a perception that somehow we're buying, you're using all this money to buy fee title to property. What this graph shows you, that only about 12%, that's the top upper kind of green one on the right, is about 12% goes to fee acquisition. 15% has gone to easement, 12% has gone to testing, 18% has gone to restoration. So the bulk of the dollars that we've spent so far out of all the legacy accounts has been for restoration. There's also in this all four legacy accounts, so you see the dark purple over there would be the arts and legacy TARP funding. And so what I think the report also shows, even if you were to, I don't know what happened here, I've hibernated, which I think a lot of our animals are doing. Olet, just to point out, the report shows that we're not getting more money or getting more money than we can have to exceed the backlog that's already occurring. All of the acquisition that we've occurred has been willing buyers that have already been on lists someplace wanting to sell their property for preservation for a number of years. And so that kind of perception that we have more money than we could we can deal with is incorrect. We haven't even started fully emptying out the backlog of lists that we already had for these programs. And I think that we're starting to get to that level, but we haven't reached it yet. And with that, I'm done with my segment of it. Hopefully we'll come back on here in a second and we'll let
Mr. Tuma. Well, while we're waiting, I have this one question. You give some examples of what wouldn't have happened without the legacy funding?
Well, what wouldn't have happened, Mr. Chairman, I think, for example, we would not have been able to continue our efforts to set aside wetland management dollars. I mean, with the veto of the bill, those dollars would not have existed, and efforts that DNR, Bowser, and all those other agencies have been making to set aside some critical lands for habitat would not have occurred. Under this scenario, you really don't know because a lot of things go into the mix. Things are balanced, and that's okay. And we expect you to balance out areas. When we set the parameters for you, we're not saying that you can ever cut a program. You might shift different programs to different things. But I think we would have lost a lot of opportunity to restore some of our state parks, with the dollars, if the dollars were not there. We would not have been anywhere near some of the legacy efforts that we've had. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think the big one always stands out to me, the excellent job we did up in the Upper Mississippi River up by Grand Rapids. That property probably would have never been acquired but for the legacy dollars. And frankly, when that, I think the length and breadth of that, when we look at that effort, is going to be somewhere akin to, the Vermilion State Park or the Boundary Waters. I mean, is that significant of a parcel of property that we've been able to preserve? And I think in the long run,
or Greenleaf, or Greenleaf.
Yes, Greenleaf too.
Yeah. One more point, Mr. Tuma. What about the identifying the level of impairments in our lakes and streams? Where would we be without the legacy funding with that? Does that apply?
It started before. I think Representative Wagenius and Senator Anderson were very aggressive and took a big risk by taking the one-time money and saying we're gonna make this effort happen, and we're gonna hope that legacy amendment passes. So they've already making good strides towards that goal and setting a strong standard for our agencies to actually test those waters. And that's good. That's a good thing, and we're on track. We've tested a significant. I think we're getting close to 40%, if I remember, of testing of our waters. And we're finding out what we found out. We knew already from what we've tested, a significant portion, like 40% of them, are polluted beyond what they can be used for. And so now the question is, can we really start restoring? I think that what Deb Swackhammer's report, I think, it was a very good foresight of the legislature and the LCCMR to put dollars, well, actually LOC, I think, put dollars towards that one, to actually start saying how can we spend our money to start restoring some of these polluted lakes. If we're not restoring these lakes and waters, just testing them over the 25 years, I think the voters will be very mad at us.
One more, Mr. Tuma. What role do you see legacy funding playing in the restoring of lakes and streams?
I think it plays a critical role. I think that's what the voters intended to do.
Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, members, Minnesota Citizens for the Arts is a citizen-led organization that is statewide, and our mission is to ensure access to the arts for all Minnesotans. We are not the state agency. However, I'm here to talk about our very high satisfaction level with the processes that the Minnesota State Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils use to figure out how to best serve the citizens of Minnesota with legacy dollars. The State Arts Board and Regional Arts Council system is statewide and serves all 87 counties. The State Arts Board's grant making is of statewide and regional significance, and the Regional Arts Councils, of which there are 11, each serve a set of local counties and have local boards made up of citizens from that area who do local decision making. The two-tier system ensures that there are opportunities for access to the arts to all Minnesotans, no matter where you live. And it also ensures that the many different arts genres and sizes of organizations who serve a large spectrum of Minnesotans in their access to the arts and arts education are participants and offer things to the citizens of Minnesota. Our story is similar to that of the conservation community on a much, much, much smaller scale. The State Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils suffered a drastic cut in funding in 2003. We lost a third of state funding at that time. And I surveyed the arts community and found over 150 jobs lost in the first month and a half after that cut had occurred. The cuts were devastating. There were programs that were canceled across the state. And it was at that time that we began conversations with the conservation community about potentially looking for a dedicated source of funding along with them. However, the conversation about a dedicated source of funding for the arts had started way back in 1991 with a study committee. Let me go to the next one. The reason we are supportive of the State Arts Board and Regional Arts Council system is multiple leveled. First of all, that when they were appropriated funds from the Legacy Amendment, they conducted a very extensive statewide process, which included hundreds and hundreds of Minnesotans bringing input to them as to what the citizens thought should be done with the funds. They did an extensive strategic planning process involving many community groups, and only after that very long process did they decide how the money would be spent. we believe that when the citizens were voting on the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment in November of 08, they understood it to be conservation and the arts. And so we ask that you appropriate at least 50% of the Arts and Culture Heritage Fund to the State Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils, because it is the traditional delivery method to make sure that all the citizens of Minnesota have access to the arts. That's not to say that the other recipients of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund do not have merit. It's just that this is the system that makes sure that actually the producers and creators of the arts in Minnesota are funded, so that the distribution systems that are also funded will have content to make sure that it gets around the state. The system, we believe, is very accountable, efficient. It requires audits under state standards from grantees. It requires final reports. The actual decision-making of the grant-making system is done by citizen panelists, of which at the State Arts Board alone there are over 100. On the Regional Arts Council level, representatives from each county sit on the panels that decide where the funds will go, so that they are responding to local needs. Also, at all levels of the system, detailed recommendations are made in terms of how much money is appropriate for each grant and what the grant will be used for, and it ensures that grant funds get to every one of Minnesota's 87 counties. So together with Conservation Minnesota, we are making a set of recommendations. Some are system-wide across all four funds, and some are specific to certain funds. The first one is to invest in what the voters intended. There is language in the Constitution that details specifically where these funds should go. And in the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, for example, it says arts, arts access, arts education, and the preservation of our history and cultural heritage. That is actually very limited language. And so each time you consider whether or not something should be funded out of this fund, you should go back and read the Constitution again and see what exactly it specifies. Because I've heard a lot of wild conversations about funding a lot of random things that don't fit that list. And so I would just ask that you go back and read that language. And the same is true for the other four funds.
And Mr. Chair, too, our second recommendation was that we continue to engage citizens for their input. We think the Arts Councils and the Lessard Councils did a wonderful job. And I think you should strongly consider something similar for Parks and Trails and for the water funds to continue to engage the citizens. That doesn't mean they make the appropriations. You are the only people authorized in the Constitution to make appropriations. But we think that you should seek out citizen input, and you should give it high value, because these are the citizens' dollars. They asked for it. It was placed on the amendment to our Constitution for them. And I think they should be engaged in that process as they go forward.
Third, transparency in investments. We've been troubled by how slowly the state has managed to get the website up where citizens can search for and see where the dollars have gone. I know that State Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils have had the data available for quite a long time, and for some reason it's still not in there and still not searchable. So a real focus on making sure that that is functional as quickly as possible is important.
And in the conservation areas in particular, the 1% level, if you can continue to maintain, we know that's a bigger decision made at higher levels, but certainly you can make the arguments that one of the standards that we're going to set is that you continue for conservation environment areas to maintain 1% of the general fund going towards those efforts. To keep the dedicated funds you've already dedicated to these areas from being raided, so that those who are contributing their hunting and fishing dollars through license and other avenues can know that their funds are protected and they're not going to be viewed as an easier way to raid those for a general fund fix. And also, as you move forward too with the if there is a bonding bill, and if you move forward with that in this year or next year, that you continue to honor that 22% be directed towards conservation programs, towards wastewater treatment facilities and the like.
And then finally, with the Arts and Culture Heritage Fund, to ensure that the majority of the resources are actually going to the arts, as it says in the constitutional language.
And Mr. Chairman and members, in order to kind of continue our collaboration, we have started, this coming weekend, February 11th, a series of visits around the state, working with WCCO-TV, with the Arts Council and Explore Minnesota, what we call Legacy Weekends. And so we're starting in Alexandria. We'll be in St. Paul in March. Representative Peel will be up in Crookston in April 15th through the 17th and on down. And so this poster is for you. Anybody else that wants those posters, wants to know any more about these weekends, we're going to try to get into the communities and show people where their dollars are going to work, because we believe they want to know that their dollars are working for them in the communities. And so we think it's imperative for those of us who advocated for this constitutional amendment to work with some of our partners, with the state agencies, and with the press, to show people exactly how those dollars are being spent, and see the good work that you've done over these last 2 years, Mr. Chairman. So I'll let the page hang on to this, but this one's for you. And if anybody else wants one, you can have it. We'll be glad to get you one. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions about their recommendations. The first is the 50% number for the State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. What does the 50% come from? What does that represent, or how did you develop that number?
Ms. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Winkler, Representative Winkler, I'm sorry.
Both are true.
When we were working on the Vote Yes campaign to pass the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment, those of us who were principally engaged in the day-to-day work, we were there to support the arts, and the 50% level and or beyond, if the committee chose to do that, would represent to us that a serious effort had been made to get money to the arts. And there are other very worthy things being funded by the Legacy Amendment, and you may notice that we don't discuss them in the report, and that's because, out of respect, I didn't want to talk about their issues. I just wanted to focus on the arts in particular.
So,
Representative Winkler.
I guess that leads to, I mean, this is kind of a tricky set of questions. The first principle is to invest in what voters intended, and I understand that your organizations spend a great deal of time and money and effort to get this passed, and yet determining what the voters intended is, you know, it's a thing to say, but nothing that could ever be done. Suppose you could do polling or something, because, you know, what was on the ballot is not what's in the Constitution. They didn't vote on that particular language. They voted on a general question. How do we go about determining the voters' intent beyond recognizing the effort of all the people who worked for the passage?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tuma. Representative Winkler, that's why we think you should have citizen input councils overseeing it. That's part of the way you do it. Certainly, you are elected officials, and we trust that your ability to appropriate is part of your job, is to represent your constituents and understand that. And that's part of this process. You're not taken out of this process. When we say engage citizens, we mean to engage citizens, take their input, but you, in the end, are the representatives of your districts and of the people of Minnesota. And so you have to make that decision and determination. Obviously, I suppose there could be a line where the courts could get involved to determine whether a particular item is outside of the parameters of what is acceptable expenditures or not. You know, we could certainly have a debate, and we've been having, and I think starting a debate on whether payment in lieu of taxes is one of those things that should be covered under the legacy funding. We would argue that it isn't. It's not that it's a bad program. It's a good idea. Gene Merriam, who's on my board of directors, was here when it was put into place, and he said it was a critical part of making sure that we had conservation funding, was to make sure local units of government had dollars for payment in lieu of taxes, but it really doesn't look like a conservation program. And so as you identify specific projects, you just have to start asking yourself, is it what Minnesotans would want to have their money spent on? And that's a tough question, and you all will bring your different perspectives to that. But I think in the long run, you've done a pretty good job so far in very tough times. And so we'll keep working with you and keep communicating with you. We're not here to bash you. Our job is just kind of to work and see through this and respect that in the end, you have to make that final decision. At some point, maybe a group or some individuals may say you've gone too far and want to use the courts to enforce that. But that would be a decision down the road. I think so far you stayed pretty well within the parameters with just a couple things that caused us some concerns outlined in the report. Could you do better? Absolutely. If it were up to me, my idea what spending water on maybe is a little different than Representative Rukavina is. So,
Mr. Chair, just a
Representative Winkler.
Final follow-up. Do you, you mentioned this, the dedicated funds and the bonding bill percentages, and you've also talked about the 1% general fund funding for conservation. But you're not suggesting that somehow passage of the legacy amendment created a legal obligation for the legislature to continue to fund, to stop making its independent decisions every 2 years on whether conservation should get funded at all or whether bonding bills should include conservation at all.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Tuma.
Representative Winkler. Yeah, what the definition of supplant versus supplanting is a difficult question. And so we're not trying to give you a legal answer. We had to struggle with this ourselves. And what I explained to people is I tried to build you a sandbox. Okay, and that sandbox from a conservation standpoint is make sure you think about, you know, one of the edges. If you stay in the sandbox, we won't get mad at you. You know, if you tell your kids that, go play in the sandbox. And so we're saying to you, as far as when we look at this, one of the edges, spend the money on what the constitutional amendment talked about, water, land, legacy, parks and trails, and the arts, and the in our history. If you stay with, that's one side of the box. Another side of the box for us is 22% of the bonding bill. Another side is don't rate our dedicated funds. Another side of that is the 1% of the general fund. That gives you some guidelines, some understanding of where we're going to be comfortable if you stay within those parameters. You could still do something within those parameters that is illegal that someone might be able to sue you on. Okay, you might even step out of that box and say you're going to not fund minerals, the mineral exploration in the DNR budget anymore. That's in the number that we have here, and you say we're going to zero that out. We probably won't sue you over that because that's really not what you would consider conservation. Maybe you can make an argument for it, maybe you couldn't, but we'd probably be okay with that. So there's other things that you can do, and we can nitpick about points, but if you can stay within those parameters, I think as a conservation community, we're going to praise you and say, good job, you did what you can, and more than likely, staying within there, you're not going to be sued from a supplanting standpoint.
Mr. Chair, my only comment would be at some point it would probably good
to have
one of those lawsuits because then we could actually see how the courts would treat that. I suspect that courts would start to look at the amount of policy discretion that they traditionally would give to the legislative branch and the very specific funding that was provided through legacy, the past general funding numbers, and they would probably get into such a factual record mess on their hands that they would start to back away. But, you know, I think I like the way the conversation goes about talking about how to fulfill the purposes and having a constructive dialogue. But I'm not sure that thinking about, you know, if we don't do this, we might get sued is the right way to do that, because I think it's very hard to predict how courts would start to interpret this.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Tuma,
I would totally agree with you. That's why we try not to talk about it in legal terms and more principal terms. As an attorney, and I know the Constitution, they would give you great deference to your appropriation because you are the body who appropriates, and I know the court would not want to get into this if they don't have to. So it would have to be a pretty clear their breach.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler has already asked many of the questions that came to my mind as we heard your presentation. I would just... some of the terminology you're using today makes me extremely uncomfortable. When an advisory groups come to us and say must, it somehow does not seem to fit your role in this process, and I would like you to try and defend your language that you're using today.
Mr. Tuma.
Mr. Chairman and Rebels and Torkelson, we're an advocacy group. That's what we do. We tell you what we think is appropriate for these funds. They were an important part of our efforts over the last decade to put in place and working with the citizens of Minnesota. And so we think we have a role in telling you how those funds should be spent. Again, we're only one voice in this process. We think we have... As a collaboration working together, an important voice, but we definitely know we're not the only voice. And so if we offended with words like please don't raid and please spend 1%, I think understand them they're meant in a way as an advocacy group is. And I don't mean to have you take them in a way to say somehow I'm going to be angry with you tomorrow if you don't follow these things. You know, we're big people. We know how this process works, and This is the standards, the things that we've set out there are parameters. If you don't like it, you got an election certificate, and go ahead and make different standards, and we'll work with you and try to be respectful in that process. These are, from sitting down in a collaborative basis, what we see as good guidelines for you to follow, and take them as guidelines and understand them, and feel free to differ from us. We want to have a communication with you, an exchange, and not an argument, but try to develop this in a positive way. That's why we like citizen councils. We think citizen councils have a role in this process. And I think you taking the lead in the water area has been refreshing, and I've been make sure that the folks that I work with are hearing that you want to make some positive changes in the water area. So I hope you don't read that our recommendations wrong. We want them to be looked at as a positive contribution to what's going on.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tumim. But I'm really hearing two different messages here. I'm hearing recommendations and collaboration, which is a language I prefer to hear and I think is the appropriate language for this process. And then I'm hearing must from the same presenters. And it, frankly, it does make me uneasy. And I guess that's more of a comment than a question.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Mr. Tuma, Ms. Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, the Minnesota Zoo rescheduled, so they will be here another time. We'll proceed now to Julie Blackburn from Bowser, and I will call your attention to a Star Tribune article that has been placed in your folder, leveling some criticism of the process, and Ms. Blackburn has a response for that from this article. Ms. Blackburn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you, Chair Erdahl, for having me here.
Identify yourself, please.
I'm Julie Blackburn, the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I was asked to present some of our comments and feedback to the report that MCA that had written about clean water funding from 2007 through 2010. They issued a report on how Bowser has done implementing the Clean Water Fund. The letter that you have from me, just as a clarification, is a response to the draft that they sent to us. We had started getting a lot of questions, calls, inquiries about all types of our data throughout the last several years, and then really starting intensively April last year, and we began just giving them all of the data that we had about all of our projects, all of our ranking, prioritization, funding, and then we just sat down with them and said, what are you trying to do? Let's make sure we're giving you all of the right information. We knew that they were going to be coming out with a report, because that tends to be what happens when somebody is accumulating that kind of data. And we asked if we could at least make sure that we had a review of their draft to make sure that they were as factually correct as possible and make sure that that all of the characterizations of what we have been doing were correct as far as we could tell. So they sent us a draft report December 27th and gave us 2 weeks to respond, write responses to it. What you have is our response to, again, their draft letter. They came out with their final report a couple weeks later. There were some changes to their final report. So before I get started on the letter, I just wanted to say a couple of things about maybe some of the differences you might see if you're reading the MCA report and you're reading the Bowser responses, why they're different. The Board of Water and Soil Resources is a board of 20. We have representation there from 15 members of citizens, as well as local units of government, including counties, cities, watershed districts, soil and water conservation districts, and townships. We also have commissioners or the commissioner appointees from Department of Health, Pollution Control Agency, Agriculture, and DNR, and we have a University of Minnesota Extension person on our board. So that's the board. We have about a little over 70 people, and we work with well over 400 units of government to implement soil and water protection measures throughout the state. So when we talk about clean water, we talk about clean water because we are about clean water. And we understand that land management is what determines the quality of water. And not just TMDLs and impaired waters, but wetlands, shorelands, rivers, streams, lakes, groundwater, all water that Minnesotans use. So we don't prioritize just on TMDLs. We prioritize over water. And what you've heard a lot of in your time here, even this legislative session, is that 40% of Minnesota's lakes and streams that have been monitored so far are impaired. We'd like to make sure that doesn't go to 41%. So we try to do a lot of protection efforts. We also believe that there's a great need to balance local priorities with state goals and state rules and regulations. I come from a local unit of government where I worked in water quality. I knew all of the farmers that I work with, many of the lake associations, my commissioners, township officers. I knew those water resources. I also had great relationships with my DNR person, my PCA person, my health person, and needed to balance what's happening with my local area with what's happening in the state. I knew those resources. I had canoed the rivers. I'd gone out and monitored our lakes. I knew where the shoreland erosion issues were. I didn't need studies in order to tell me that. I was the eyes of it and talked with the locals that knew the issues. Bowser is also about getting things done out on the ground. We believe in great data, and we believe that it shouldn't wait. Getting good projects done shouldn't wait until we have that ever more precise detail of TMDL plans to tell us where problems might be. I already knew where there was a feedlot problem before there was a TMDL. So we can't wait for the most precise data when we know that there's a problem. We aren't about waiting. We're about getting good things done. And we also do all of our work on private lands. So that's a little bit of a different scope maybe than some of the recommendations that are brought forward, such as working on stormwater that's owned by cities. We don't work on infrastructure, and we never have worked on the infrastructure. So just with those kind of caveats about how we do our work, I just want to highlight a couple of things in our letter. And again, it was a letter to the draft report. It's not the same report that's issued now. So when we have our pages of our partial listing of some factual errors in there, we have page numbers that we found the errors. Those aren't going to correspond to the report that's out there right now because it's been changed a bit. And quite frankly, I haven't gone back to correct those things. First of all, when they started, they looked at all of the projects from 2007 to 2010 that we've approved. And when 2007 projects were going forward, it was the start of the Clean Water Legacy Act. At that point, the money that had been coming for clean water projects, determining water quality trends, working on local water management plans, doing implementation, had been starved by over 40% in the previous decade. So we already had some critical capacity issues, critical data issues, things that were missing from us being able to target as well as we wish we could have, because there just simply wasn't that information there. But from 2007 to current, there has been enormous strides in the amount of targeting, in the amount of studies that the PCA has been able to go out and do during their 10-year assessment, in the amount of clean water management plans that have been updated to increase the amount of data in those plans, such as including LIDAR in their planning efforts. And so that precision of data has already built into a lot more targeting. But when they were looking at things from 2007, it wasn't the same picture as it is today. We've come a long way. So that was the first thing. The other thing is they have a much different philosophy about what they call non-point and what we consider non-point. We actually try not to use those words anymore because I don't think they're quite accurate. It might be regulatory versus non-regulatory. What they consider to be non-point and how they characterize our use of funds then using their own definition They say that Nonpoint is only agriculture. Well, that means in my property in Cottage Grove, if I was to put in a rain garden, that would be considered point source type funding. And we don't believe that to be accurate. We don't consider Nonpoint only agriculture, or we wouldn't be able to do a lot of work throughout the state cleaning up water. So that was a major philosophical difference that we believe mischaracterizes their report compared to what we would report it as. We also think that when they equate local water management plans to TMDL studies, it also creates a mischaracterization. Local water management plans have never been expected to have the amount of detail and precision that they expect out of a TMDL plan. They're 10-year comprehensive plans that are meant to address a broad range of resource issues, again, having to do with land management. They address shoreland issues, wellhead issues, groundwater issues, not just TMDLs. And they were 10-year plans. Kind of like if I was to say, in the next 10 years, I'd like to make it to every single one of the state parks in the state of Minnesota. As I come up on the next year of planning my vacations, then I get to the precision of exactly where am I going to go. So we've never expected 10-year management plans to have the level of detail that a TMDL is. When people are submitting their proposals to us, we refer to those priorities that are in their local water management plans, but we expect precision at that time. We want to know what they're doing at that time. So when MCA is reporting it back to not having precise details in the plan, yes, we don't expect 10-year plans to have those kinds of details. We want to have them as they're moving forward on their plans, getting more details, more data about where is the best place to do projects. We absolutely acknowledge that when you have a plan to go out and work with voluntary landowners, sometimes voluntary landowners decide not to do a project. That's one of the criticisms in their report. That's correct. When we work with private landowners, they have a right to make a decision about what to do with their land. And that's why we believe that local SWCD person or county person or watershed person is the most important link in that system of delivery of getting these voluntary programs out there, because they can sit down and talk to somebody that they know. So that is part of doing voluntary activities in the state. People can choose whether or not to participate. And that's why sometimes what actually ends up on the ground was different than what people have submitted as part of their application. We have to be nimble. You go out there and you think you've got five landowners that are all ready to go. There might be a change in the family ownership. There might be a change in jobs, change in all kinds of things that we can't anticipate. They back out of something that we thought they were ready to go on. We find somebody else. They might still be doing the same type of, or maybe even a different project activity that goes to the same water quality goal. So we might have some differences in what actually got implemented from what was applied for. That's voluntary program management. We want to make sure that we still have the ability to get those things done. And the last thing that we commented on in our letter is that they state that they think water quality assessments should be provided on every single project. And that goes back to what I said about getting things done. We think if we were to do monitoring on every single project, it would greatly divert the amount of funds that we would be able to put in getting things done on the land. So we disagree with that. We believe there should be great science behind all of our best management practices that we're putting in there, that they should be evaluated by institutions that do research, that we should make sure that they report based on what they did on those implementation projects, and that we should use the best science available for that. But we can't monitor every project, or we won't be doing very many projects anymore, because it's very expensive. So with that, I'd just like to leave you with that. That's our main thing. We're about clean water, getting things done, using best available data, and pairing local resources with state goals.
Thank you, Ms. Blackburn. Comments, questions from members?
Mm-hmm.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Director Blackburn, I think it's interesting that a group that spent hundreds of thousands of dollars filing a lawsuit in northern Minnesota over the abandonment of a beaver dam would think that something as wise as rain gardens isn't wise use of money. I guess I don't even care if you comment about it.
Chair Erdahl and Representative McNamara, I wouldn't know what to say.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Blackburn.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.